Good evening. I'm not going to lie, I almost went off script tonight just because the lesson this morning had me thinking, not that I could even do a part B any justice, but had me thinking a lot about that analogy. It had me thinking about the many times sitting at grandma's dinner table and talking about life and the things in life and just the encouragement that was found there and the strength that was found there. Makes me think about all the time I spend on the phone with my mom, maybe after a rough day at work, talking to her just to either vent or to get some kind of strength from that. And just that correlation between the church and mothers this morning, I was just like, man, there's so many things I wish I could run with on that. But I'm going to be a team player and I'm going to stay on script tonight. Most of our lesson, the building blocks of our lesson tonight are going to come from Numbers chapter 13 and 14. Numbers chapter 13 and 14. You know, you've heard people say many times that you continue to study the Bible and texts that you've read and studied numerous times. Every time you go back and study it, new things jump out at you. That's why from a preacher's perspective or a teacher's perspective, anytime I'm asked to speak or teach on something that I've already got a lesson on, I always go back and restudy it because I always end up changing that lesson that I've done before because something jumps out at me that never has before. We're all familiar with Caleb and Joshua being two of the 12 spies that were sent in to take a look at the land of Canaan, the land that God promised to their people. And even our lesson tonight, the idea of having the courage to stand up, the courage to speak up when the majority seems to be against you. And I've taught on that before. I've heard it taught on many times. But I think we get the cart before the horse when we talk about that topic because we have to get down to the why or the how. Why could these men have that courage? Or how could these men have that courage? Because I could give you a great motivational speech tonight. There's a lot, you know, I think in this day and age, probably the revenue and in many eyes, the desire for motivational speakers are probably higher than ever. Everybody's trying to be one. You name the community, they're trying to do it. In the fitness community, everybody wants to be an Instagram influencer and motivate you to get up out of bed and do something at 4 o'clock in the morning when everybody else is sleeping. Military men are coming out of the military and now they're motivational speakers and they're telling you how to be hard, how to be tough and all these different things. That's great and all, but the problem is motivation is fleeting. You have the motivation one day, and then the motivation fades. That's why discipline, many will say, is greater than motivation. Because discipline sticks around on the days that you don't want to get up and do something. On the days that you don't want to go to work, or on the days that you don't want to do that chore, or this or that, or the days you just don't feel like it. Discipline takes over in those moments. So, while, yes, we're going to get to the topic of the courage of these men, I want to spend more time thinking of the how and the why. How could they have it? Why did they have it? Because I think that's where, when we get to that and we focus on that I don't believe this is just an overnight transformation. I think that's one of the things that I've been guilty of in my Christian walk is that I've expected things to be overnight transformations. And honestly, we kind of, from the pulpit a lot of times, sometimes we treat it like overnight transformations. You think about it, we get discouraged that when people hear the gospel one time and they say, you know what, I think that's right, and then they don't respond immediately. But the honest truth is, it's not an overnight thing. To make a big commitment like becoming a Christian, I mean, come on, that's the biggest commitment you can make in your life. That's not an overnight, you know, just for most people, an overnight, just boom, okay, I've made that decision, here we go. These transformations, these things, these changes in our lives, they're not overnight transformations. They take time. One of the things that I've been guilty of, and Brittany will tell you this, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I'm a big advocate of Mental Health Awareness Month as someone that suffers from many different mental health issues, okay? So I'm a big advocate of it. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't wear it like this badge of honor, like, oh, because I feel this way today, that makes me special. No, but at the same time, I'm an advocate of it because I do believe it needs to be talked about more. I believe it needs to be brought into the light more and treated just as any other illness. Thoughts of positive affirmation, right? Positive affirmation, saying positive things over and over. I was always against that, at least for me. I always would tell Brittany, that doesn't work. Okay, I've tried it, it doesn't work. I've tried it, it doesn't work. And then I had someone put a different spin on it, and they it's funny when you can take things and manipulate them, or you know, kind of cause them to relate to your everyday life, things can start to make more sense. And I had someone look at me and say, okay, positive affirmation, those thoughts of affirmation, they don't work, okay? Let me ask you this question, Eric. Does one repetition work? Yes and no. It takes multiple to build strength. It takes multiple to build muscle. It takes multiple to build endurance. It takes multiple to build all these things. And then they just kind of looked at me. And I stopped and I said, I get it now. It may not happen. It may not change overnight. It may not change a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, but 10 years from now. So when they spun it to something that made sense to me, I thought, okay, maybe there's something to this. And while I don't claim to say, okay, I'm the positive affirmation king here, I will say that I try to remind myself of these positive things, and then I try to remind myself that these are just merely repetitions that are building towards a stronger foundation, toward a stronger base. And over time, they're going to build into something strong. Something that I can really hold on to and hang my hat on. And I think that's where we get to this courage of Caleb and Joshua. It was this idea of repeating over and over in their heads, repeating to themselves, God has promised us something. And because God has promised us something, He's going to deliver on that. We sing the song, right? Standing on the promises of Christ my King. Sometimes I wonder if we would go throughout our days and like these thoughts of positive affirmation, if we would just ponder and just reflect and just repeat over and over and over in our minds the promises of God. The promises of God. In fact, in Numbers chapter 13 and verse 2, what's amazing is before these spies were even sent out, notice what is said. The Lord spoke to Moses, verse 1, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which what? I am giving to you. There's a promise. Send these men to go and spy out on this land because I'm giving you this land. God promised them the land. I'm going to give this land to you. So send your men to spy it out. The land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the people of Israel from each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, everyone a chief amongst them. So Moses sends out the 12 spies, two being Caleb and Joshua, and these men spent 40 days traveling undetected through unknown territory. You know, this is almost a task, if you want to kind of relate it to something modern day, this is something that you think about with like, the Navy SEALs. Okay, their job is to go out, be few in number, get in, get out undetected. But even them, they at least have some sort of overlay of the land. Whether it be a map, whether it be, you know, a drone that has flown over the land and give them some kind of visual. These guys didn't have that. They go into this land that they don't really know about. They don't know the terrain, and they don't just spend, you know, 2 days in there. They spend 40 days undetected. If that right there shouldn't have given them the courage, if that right there shouldn't have helped them realize that God's hand was in all this, I don't know what else will. But they go in, they spend 40 days traveling undetected through this territory. And then they come back and they report everything that they've witnessed.
See, these spies come back and they talk about, man, this is the land that is flowing with milk and honey. This land is amazing. This land, if we lived there, we would be set for life. But there's giants there. If we go in there, 10 of the spies said, we'll fall by the sword. They'll destroy us. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the size. We don't have the ability. You name it. We don't have it to overtake these people. But Caleb quieted the people, verse 30. Quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and let's occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. Then the men who had gone up with him said, we're not able to go up against the people. They're stronger than we are. So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, the land through which we had gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who came from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them. Caleb, let's go up and do this. We can do this. We have the ability to overthrow these people. But as is often said, there's strength in numbers. Oftentimes we'll listen to the mass rather than listen to the minority. The other 10 go out and say, guys, look, we felt like grasshoppers to them. And even to them, we would look like grasshoppers. These people devour their own inhabitants. These are barbarians. These are barbaric people. These aren't civilized people, okay? We don't stand a chance. And the thing about it is throughout this situation, you know, this disagreement between the spies, this concerned God, because ultimately what they were doing is they were sowing seeds of doubt. Can God really make good on His promise? Can God really provide us this land? Are these people really are they stronger than our God? Could He really give us the land that He promised Abraham? So Caleb and Joshua, they're the two that stand firm on the promise of God. Let's do this. Let's go in. We can overcome this obstacle. But the other 10, they weren't sold. And sadly, the congregation of Israel, they don't side with Caleb and Joshua. They cried out and asked, why is the Lord bringing us in this land to kill us by the sword? In chapter 14. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? And Caleb and Joshua, they plead to these people. They plead in chapter 14 and they say, look, if the Lord delights in us, He will bring us into this land and He will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Listen, guys, God has found delight in us, and if He continues to find delight in us, if we continue to just submit to Him, if we continue to trust in Him, we're going to win this. We're going to win this. So don't rebel against us, but also don't rebel against God. Don't rebel against God. But the thing about it is, the Israelites were so discouraged by this. Notice how crazy their thinking becomes. They were ready to go back to Egypt. You think about how bad they had it in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. But this isn't the first time. Throughout the wilderness, it didn't take but just a few days of them in the wilderness crying, did the Lord bring us out here to starve? Did the Lord bring us out here to die? Let's go back to Egypt. At least we had food there. It may have been really bad, but we at least had something to eat. Three times. Three times in Numbers 14, Egypt is mentioned by name. They cry out and they say, would that we have died in the land of Egypt, or would that we have died in this wilderness? They go on to say, would it not have been better for us to go back to Egypt? He says, they say, let us choose a leader and let us go back to Egypt. They were ready to form a coup. They were ready to overthrow Moses and say, look, we want a new leader. We want someone else in charge that's not going to listen to this voice, that's going to listen to us and what we want. And when we get that leader, let's go back to Egypt. Do they really think, first of all, I mean, even if Egypt accepts them back, they're going to go back into slavery. They're going to go back to having it even worse. Odds are, though, after all the carnage and chaos that they caused in Egypt and making their Pharaoh look as if he was nothing, odds are they'd just kill him anyway. I doubt Egypt would even take them back. They would probably just slaughter every single one of them. I mean, you think about it. Your Pharaoh is supposed to be the strongest ruler. And your gods are supposed to be the strongest gods. And then these people that made you look like fools come back saying, hey, will you take us back? Probably not. They're probably just going to murder them right then and there. And judging from the history of how they were murdering the Hebrew baby boys, yeah, they probably would. At least the men. Murder the men. So to get to this cynical point where you think it's better to go back to Egypt. But then God intervenes. And God pronounces judgment upon the people of Israel. Since they did not have the faith to follow God into battle and face the enemy, they would not receive this wonderful land of promise. However, Caleb and Joshua, they did have the faith to follow God into battle. And God would grant them a future in the land of promise. We focus on the courage. We focus on the bravery of Caleb and Joshua to stand up, to be a voice of reason, even when the masses do not agree. And that seems very relevant to today. This area that we live in, the Cookeville, Livingston, Jackson County area, you know, this region of the Upper Cumberland, we are, and I don't say this as an insult, I say this with pride, we are several years behind some of this progressiveness that's going on. And I'm thankful for it. I don't think that's an insult at all. But if you get out of your bubble here in this area, it is happening and becoming more and more, not only prevalent, but also vocal, more and more vocal. And it becomes vocal in our state. It becomes vocal nationwide. And then you start hearing terms thrown around like those Christians are bigots. They're bigots because they stand for and stand against certain things. And it's really easy to feel as if your voice has been silenced. And it's really easy to let the numbers oftentimes cause us to cower in fear. I didn't realize how difficult it was until I started working at the bank. Working at the bank has been a whole new ballgame for me. Just coming in contact with a company that is very progressive, has a lot of core values that go against everything God stands for. And a group of people that, you know, you work with on a daily basis that continually try to put you in a corner on what you believe. You say, well, you know, they don't talk about that. Yeah, they do. And here's the thing about it is the moment they find out that you were a preacher, they're going to bring it up even more. The thing about it is, I welcome it. I'm thankful for conversation. But a lot of times I will ask them, now, do you want to have a conversation about this before I say anything? If you want to have a civil conversation, I'll be more than happy to. But if this is going to become either just a one-way conversation or the moment I give, you know, my thoughts on it, where you start, you know, getting heated on this, I just don't want to have it. But I had a boss that looked at me the other day and wanted to bring up divorce and remarriage.
Hey, I'm not against divorce, she said. I think that it's better to just be divorced and be happy and to go on your life. And if you want to marry someone else for whatever reason, marry them. It's better for y'all to be happy than to be miserable in your marriage and this and that. And my rule of thumb is give your marriage 3 or 4 months. And if it isn't better in 3 or 4 months, part ways. We had a conversation about it. But it was really unnerving and unsettling because in the back of my mind, there were those thoughts of doubts of, what if I get on this boss's bad side? What if this costs me a promotion one day? Or what if this costs me my job because of this? But then you have to go back and you have to be reminded of the promises of God, just as Caleb and Joshua were. You see, there's a lot of parallel here that I really didn't think about until I was studying for this lesson, because so many times I focused on their courage and their faith that I overlooked the why. I overlooked the how. And when I started looking into the why, when I started looking into the how, I really started seeing how this scenario right here plays out in our everyday Christian lives. Because the thing about it is the moment, I don't want to get political because I don't think this is a political topic. I think it's more about morality than anything. But you think about how, and it's on the forefront of our minds right now, so I hate to not even bring it up as an illustration here, but Roe v. Wade is becoming more and more prevalent. And as a Christian, I'm not ashamed to tell you this. I'm not pro-abortion. I'm not. Because I believe that just as it's our job to care for the widows and the orphans, it's our job to care for those that can't defend themselves in the womb. And I don't believe it's an argument of my body, my choice, because that body inside of you that's going to be killed is not your body. But I do believe that the answer to the problem is not in the courts. I don't believe sin issues are not going to be won in court. Sin issues are matters of the heart and can only be won by changing the hearts of others. And I do believe the church has to do more to combat this than just simply saying, Christians, go out and vote. Maybe we start thinking about how can we help families that are wanting to adopt children, afford to adopt. I don't know if you've never adopted. It's not a cheap fee. Maybe we start thinking about how can we make sure good Christian families can adopt. And maybe we start looking at these young teenage mothers or these mothers that are in these tough situations and we start caring for them and we start ministering to them. We start giving them hope so that they don't think this is the only way for me to have a future and to have a life. See, simply voting for or against something is not going to solve the problem. You cannot force morality on people. You can't. We have to change the hearts of people. How do we do that? We remind people of the promises of God. So let's look at some of those with the rest of our time that we have, what little time we have left. I want us to look closely. I want us to see that this story here parallels very, very closely to the Christian life. In more ways than just one. Israel was in bondage. They were slaves to Egypt. According to Paul, you and I were slaves once. We were in bondage. We were slaves to sin. And just as Israel needed to be freed from their bondage, we too needed to be freed from our bondage. And just as Israel was brought into a holy covenant with God, we too were brought into a holy covenant, a relationship with God. And just as they were told that they would be given a wonderful home in a land that was flowing with milk and honey, you and I were told that we would be given a land, as John's revelation reveals, that has streets of gold. A land where there's no more sorrow. There's no more pain. A place that God will wipe every tear away from His children's eyes. A place that we will dwell in the presence of God forever. Romans chapter 6, verses 6 and 7 says,
We know that our old self was crucified with Him in order that the body of sin might be brought to nothing, so that we would no longer be enslaved to sin. For one who has died has been set free from sin. And because we have been set free from sin, we as Christians have been chosen to be a holy nation in this covenant relationship with God. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10 says, "But you're a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood. You're a holy nation. You're a people for His own possession. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people." And we are told, as I said earlier, that we will be given a home and a wonderful place where we can dwell together in God's presence. Revelation 21, beginning with verse 2, says, "And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." He says, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be His people. And God Himself will be with them as their God.'" You see, that whole relationship that was severed in the garden will be restored. That just as God dwelt with man and walked with man, had that relationship with man, that relationship will be restored again. But you see, here's the thing. God brought you out of bondage. He brought you into a relationship with Him. He's promised this land flowing with milk and honey to you. But that doesn't mean there aren't going to be giants in our way. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be trials and tribulations that we will face. That doesn't mean that life's not going to be discouraging at times and that it's going to be difficult for us at times. For Israel, it was the mighty warriors that seemed as if they were just unbeatable. Unbeatable. You see, they didn't have the faith that they needed to trust in God and follow Him through those challenges. Their decision was, we would rather return to our enslavement. We would rather return to our former life than go through this. We as Christians will have to face extremely difficult challenges as well. There will be moments of doubt. There will be moments of doubt about whether or not God actually hears us when we pray, or whether He really did redeem us from our sin, from our former life, whether or not He truly does have the power to defeat death. When faced with these challenges, many Christians want to go back to Egypt. Many Christians want to go back to that former life and just say it's too hard. It's too hard. And look, I'm not going to stand up here and be this, portray that I'm this perfect example, that I've never had those doubts and that I don't still have those doubts at times in my life where I just, is it worth it? Can I get through it? Can I be strong enough to do it? Lord, I just want to go back to Egypt. Just let me go back there. I know it's not always easy, but it feels easier in this moment. It seems like it would be better in this moment. I just want to go back to that, what I'm used to. When we turn from God and we engage in that former life, we're making the same decision that the Israelites made, that those 10 spies made. That we see the mountain, we see the challenge, but we forget about the God that we serve. We forget about the God that has the ability to make that mountain seem like a molehill. We forget about that faith that has the power to say to that sycamore tree, be uprooted. We forget about the faith that has that power to look at that mountain and say, move, get out the way, and the mountain moves. Because of that faith, we forget about the promised land. We forget about the promised land that's waiting for us. That just as God says, look, I am giving this land to the people of Israel, God has said, I am giving this land, this home, to my people. It's theirs. It's yours. Paul used this kind of language when he warned the Christians in Galatia about turning back to sinful ways. In Galatians chapter 4, beginning with verse 9, he says, but now that you have come to know God, or rather be known by God. I love that phrase there. He doesn't just say, you now know God, but rather you're now known by God. God knows you. See, we a lot of times say we know people that we really don't know. No, people say, well, I know Donald Trump. No, you don't. You don't know him. You ain't never sat down at a meal with him, talked to him, got to know him. You know him. Why? Because you've seen him on TV. You've read stuff, this and that. Or I know this person, or I know that person. No, you don't. You know of them, but you don't really know them. He says, not only do you really know God, but he says something even more spectacular. He knows you. That means he intimately knows you. He has a relationship with you. He cares for you. How can you turn back again to the weak and elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? Two things here. 2 points here Paul brings up to say, okay, because of this and because of this, why would you ever even consider going back to that? One, because you know God. Because you know Him. But do you really know Him? See, to really get to know someone, you have to spend time with someone. I think we had a lot of good intentions with these things, but I think we kind of missed the boat a little bit on the importance of this and why we should do this. Growing up, it was our custom growing up that every Sunday you'd be asked this question. Any daily Bible readers today? And people in the classrooms, you know, would raise their hands, and you'd have people going around to different classrooms with their board, and they would mark down how many in this classroom, how many in the auditorium, and then they'd put that number up on the wall, you know, where we put the attendance and all that. I'm really thankful, just random, you know, my ADHD squirrel moment. I'm thankful we don't have the numbers sitting up here. Can I tell you why? Because when it sets up right here in front of the congregation, you know what it displays to the congregation? That those numbers growing, increasing, and that contribution number, that's the most important thing. That's how we count growth. That's special. I'm glad they sit out there. Thank you. Thank you, elders, for that. I'm glad that something like this right here sits up in front. Love God, love others. Because that's the most important visual point right there. But they'd walk around and then we'd put that number up on the board. Man, as a kid, I wanted to be that daily Bible reader because I wanted to be part of that number and this and that. But the whole purpose of wanting people to be a daily Bible reader should be more than just checking off that box of, hey, I'm a daily Bible reader, or hey, I've read the Bible through in a whole year. It's, hey, my relationship with God is closer because I've spent some intimacy with God. I've had intimate time of reading, of studying, of hearing from God, and then I spent intimate time talking to God. You know, I've asked people before, because I'll be honest with you. I've never read the Bible through from Genesis to Revelation in 1 year. You want to know why, though? It's not because I don't read my Bible. It's because I get so sidetracked on other things in my Bible that I just don't stick to one of those plans. And oftentimes I've asked people that have read the Bible through in 1 year, I say, okay, what did you learn? And they'll say, I don't know. I don't remember. What did you really grow? What grew from it? What changed in your relationship from God from it? And they say, I don't know, but I read, you know, hey, I made it through Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. I did it. And then the rest was smooth sailing because Leviticus is not always the funnest book to read. But what did you learn from it? Look, I don't care if you've read Genesis to Revelation cover to cover in a year, or if you spent a whole year on the Gospel of John. The purpose of being diligent in our study is to know God. Not just so we can check off and say, I've read the Bible through Genesis, Revelation 50, 100 times in my life. What changed because of it, though? And if you can't answer that question, hey, if you can do that and you can answer that question, please, by all means, continue to do it. But if you're doing that and you can't answer that question, maybe you need to find a different route, a different technique. So he says, because you know God, you would be foolish to go back to that weak and elementary sinful life. He says, also though, because you now know that God knows you. And because you know God knows you, you know God cares. And you know God knows what's best for you. And you know that God will stand behind every promise that He has ever said. Because it goes against His very nature. Whereas Paul would put it, it is impossible for God to tell a lie. Caleb and Joshua were two men who knew that God could conquer any challenge. Because they were willing to faithfully follow God, He granted them that land of rest, the land of Canaan. We will face trials in our lives. Any of you ever heard this phrase? God will never allow me to go through anything in life that I can't handle. You ever heard that phrase? Sounds good. Looks good on a t-shirt or on a picture frame. I don't believe it's true. But Eric, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 says, there is no temptation that will overtake you, that with every temptation, God provides a way of escape. Yeah, that's a key word there, temptation. Scripture uses two words to talk about the things we face in life. Temptations and trials. Temptations are things that come from within. Trials are external circumstances that happen in this life. There is nothing that you'll ever be tempted with, God says, that you won't be provided a way of escape for. But if I truly believe then, think about this with me for a second. Let's think about this logically and critically here. If I truly believe that there's nothing in life that God will ever allow to happen to me that I can get through by myself, then why do I need God? The very fact that Jesus had to die on the cross so that my sin could be forgiven tells me that there's at least been one thing in this life that I can't get through on my own. And it was that. Trials are the circumstances in life. And I don't know about you, but there are many things that happen in life that I think I'm going to be prepared for, and when they happen, I'm not prepared. And that there's no way I'm getting through it by myself. If I could get through it on my own, then why would we need Scripture like, bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ? Why didn't Paul just say, pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get through it? We're going to face trials that are going to cause us to have doubts. And it's in those times we need to be someone's Joshua and someone's Caleb that we can get through this together. We just have to be reminded about the promises that God has laid out before us. And it's through those times and before those times, more so before. Scriptures like James chapter 1, they're not scriptures that we go to during the times. They're scriptures that we go to before the times to prepare us for the times that are coming ahead. Consider it all joy, my brothers, when you fall into various trials and temptations, right? Does anybody like hearing that when they're going through it? No. I hate hearing it. Those are the scriptures that we go to prepare us. Because it's not a matter of if they happen, it's when they happen. And we go to those scriptures to prepare us, to strengthen us, to build ourselves up for it. And it's during those times, though, when it happens, that we focus, we ground ourselves on the promises that God has laid out. The things in our life, because here's the thing, life seems, you ever felt like your life has just been completely turned upside down? It's shaken? You've been moved? The promises are God. They're the anchors. They're the things that hold, that we hold on to, that when everything is shaking around us and everything seems to be turned upside down, it's the one thing that stays solid. It's the one thing that keeps us grounded during these situations. We have to have the trust the faith in God to know that He can take us successfully through anything. Because if we're on this earth very long at all, we're going to have to face the most difficult challenge of all. I haven't had the experience losing my parents yet. I haven't had to experience that. But I have had to experience losing some of those amazing, amazing just foundations or pillars, as we call them in the church, pillars in the church. At 18 years old, at school, normal day, like any other day, get a call. Voicemail on my phone. That was when we only had flip phones. I knew something was up because Mom was like, "Hey, get home whenever, as quick as you can." And me being me, when I see red, I go. And I went off running towards the door to leave the school. And the guy that was over in school suspension went to grab me by the arm. And I gave a little shove. I apologize. Because I knew something bad was happening, and I had to get going. I didn't have time to waste time talking to you about it and asking your permission. Your permission or not, I'm going out that door. And then the teacher came running behind me and said, just let him go. I'll explain to you. Let him go. Let him go. Evidently, she knew more time than me. So I pull in. My mind always goes to my dad because my dad's been one of those, like, I think about the last 5 years. I mean, he had a tree fall on him and crush his ribs. He flipped a lawnmower and almost cut his foot off. Like, works, you know, was a lineman at the time, all these different things. I'm just like, oh, something's happened to Dad, so I'm gone. But I get there and there's an ambulance backed up the hill into my grandma's driveway, and my heart just sank. And I remember walking in the living room, and it's an image that's etched in my mind. I remember seeing my grandmother lay there on the couch. And I remember how my faith at that moment felt. And then you fast forward a few years in college, I get a call from Mom, and I just got home from this mountaintop experience. Okay, I was the chaplain in our social club. I just got back from a retreat that I had planned, and man, it was great. We were one of the first social clubs to have like an actual, because I mean, you think about it, when you think about going to a Christian school, you think about, you know, automatically your mind assumes that the majority of these people, if not all of them, are already Christians. Honest truth is they're not. And we just had a baptism at our retreat, and I was so excited, and it was so good. And I went back to the congregation I was the youth minister at, worshiped with them, and I was driving home. And then Mom calls me, and she says, "Hey, are you driving?" And I say, "Yeah, what's up?" She says, "Call me when you're not." So I pull over, and I say, "No, we're not doing this. We're having this conversation now. I can't do, I'm one of these people, just tell me." And she breaks down, she says, "I'm just going to tell you," she says, "Dwayne took his life." The man who, he taught me how to play guitar in his office. The man who came to hear me, he told the elders where he was preaching at the time. When I preached my first sermon, he said, "Hey guys, you're going to have to, I have to get a fill in, I'm going and hearing him." But in that moment, this is going to sound corny maybe to some of you, but to me it was the anchor that kept some sanity on me. I just saw something when I drove, and I'm not one of these sentimental people like this. But as I was driving to get that phone call to get to a place where I could stop, I remember I saw something, and what I saw was there was a rainbow. And in that moment, it was the only thing I could anchor myself to, because that rainbow reminds me of a promise from God. We are all going to face these shaking things in our life. And for most of us, the most difficult thing we will face involves death. And it's in those moments we have to be anchored. We have to be anchored on the promises of God. So whether it be something internal that we're going through in our life, whether it be something external that we're going through in our nation, in our communities, in our families, it's in those moments we have to be reminded that just as God said, "I can defeat these giants," to Caleb and Joshua, He says to us, I can defeat these giants. I can defeat them. Oh, death, where's your sting? Oh, death, where's your victory, Paul says. Just as Jesus defeated death, we're reminded that that still takes place. That death has been defeated. That death doesn't have to be an eternal separation, but merely a temporary one. Think about the words of James in James chapter 1 and verse 12 when he says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. When he has stood the test, he'll receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. The 12 spies show us, or the 10 spies, show us that turning back to enslavement is not the answer. Caleb and Joshua show us that if we remind ourselves, if we stand on the promises of God, that we can have the faith, that we can have the courage to push forward, to move forward, to stand up, even when it seems as if we're the minority. I want to leave you with Romans chapter 6 and verse 22. But now that you have been set free from sin and have become slaves of God, the fruit you get leads to sanctification, and its end, eternal life. As Paul would go on to say in Romans chapter 8, we are more than conquerors through Christ. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, we want to welcome you into that family of God. We want to give you, let you receive that promise of God, that promise of not only the forgiveness of your sins, but a promise of a relationship with Him, a promise of a home with Him for eternity. If you have that need, we want to take care of it. If you're struggling tonight, we want to help bring your focus back on the promises of God. We want to help lift you up. We want to help you carry that burden so that you can regain your strength to continue moving forward. If you have a need tonight, please come while we stand and while we sing.